I'd like to read from the Bible. I would like to read from the second book of Kings and the third chapter. Second Kings chapter 3, reading from verse 1. Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel at Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and reigned 12 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father and mother, for he put away the sacred pillar of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he persisted in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. He did not depart from them. Now Mesher, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, and he regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But it happened, when Ahab died, that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So King Jehoram went out of Samaria at that time and mustered all Israel. Then he went and sent to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, saying, "The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab?" And he said, "I will go up. I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses." Then he said, "Which way shall we go up?" And he answered, "By way of the wilderness of Edom." So the king of Israel went with the king of Judah and the king of Edom, and they marched on that roundabout route 7 days. And there was no water for the army, nor for the animals that followed them. And the king of Israel said, "Alas, for the Lord has called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." But Jehoshaphat said, "Is there no prophet of the Lord here, that we may inquire of the Lord by him?" I'll leave it there. Well, there's a lot of king this and king that. What on earth can we learn from that passage? On the face of it, not very much. Not very much happens, and there doesn't seem to be much which is edifying. We have four kings. So I'll give you a little bit of historical background before we look at what happens. I'm going to make 3 points today. There are three lessons which we can learn from the text. But the background. The background is that there is a new king in Israel, and there was a king of Moab who sent him tribute every year. And because the old king died and the new king took over, the king of Moab thought, this is a great opportunity not to have to send all those lambs and sheep. The king of Israel is not terribly pleased. He likes his lambs and his sheep, or his wool. So he has an alliance with the king of a country called Edom, and he contacts the king of Judah, his southern neighbour, and says, "Let's form an alliance and go and attack Moab so I get my wool back." And so they all agree to go together. And the king of Israel has a cunning plan. You see, Moab is very well defended on the northern side. But the king of Israel is a good general. He has worked out that on the southern border, it is not well defended. So if we can take our army south and then go to Moab and invade Moab through its least defended border, we will win. But it all goes wrong because they run out of water. And I ended with King Jehoshaphat, who was a fairly godly man, saying, "Is there no prophet of the Lord here?" Now, if anyone's read ahead, the answer is actually yes, there is. But I'm not going to go there yet. So, four kings, three of whom are in an alliance against a fourth one. Well, first of all, let's consider the king of Israel, Jehoram. Ahab, his father, has died. Now, Ahab was a really, really unpleasant character. He abandoned the worship of the living God and worshipped a fertility god called Baal or Baal. It can just mean Lord. Baal was a storm god, a weather god, a rain god, quite a useful God to know if you live in a dry country, but he wasn't real. So he wasn't all that useful to know after all. And we're told he wasn't as bad as his father. How do I know that? Well, we're told in verse 2, he did do evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father. He's not that bad. We also know that there was a pillar of Baal. Whether it was a huge statue of the pagan god, whether it was a phallic symbol, quite possibly, it were not sure. But he removed it. And yet, we're told, he still did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Now, if I were to ask you the question, are you a good person? And I imagine you're all forming an answer to that in your head right now. It depends, of course, upon whom you're comparing yourself to. Now, you might think of a saintly grandmother. And you might think, well, actually, yeah, perhaps I'm not that good. But then you might think, but I'm not a Jimmy Savile. Thank God. I don't have a long criminal record. I don't tend to steal or murder people. And there are plenty of those who do. The prisons of the United Kingdom are bursting. In fact, there are so many people in our prisons that the government is having to let them go out early to make room for all the other ones who are queuing up to go in. That's one way of bringing down the prison population, isn't it? So if you want to compare yourself to them, you're right, you're quite good. You're respectable. You're civil. You're polite. You're good. You're helpful. Compared to Ahab, Jehoram is quite a good man. And yet we're told he still did evil in the sight of the Lord. Ah, but he removed the pillar. He still did evil in the eyes of the Lord. But he wasn't like his father, but he still did evil in the eyes of the Lord. What if the standard for good or bad is determined by God and not by you? I remember my friend at school. We'd have, when I was a pupil, that is, we'd have an end of year exam in every subject. And he would tell his mum the percentage. And she would always insist that 50% was the pass mark. So if he got 48%, not so good. But if he got 51, he's passed it. Now, why she determined on 50%, I don't know. My own view is that if you've studied a subject for a year and you can't even remember, you can only remember half of it, you've probably wasted a year. But there you go. And of course, we know that in public exams, the grade boundaries change every year. You don't know what it is from one year to another. But what if God determines the pass mark, just like the exam board determines a pass mark for an A-level? You might think that 75% is a really good score. The exam board might say, actually, we're making an E grade this year because most people got above 80. That wouldn't surprise me either. From a human point of view, Jehoram is not all that bad. From God's perspective, he's an evildoer. So you may never have stolen, but you've probably coveted. You may never have murdered, but I dare say you've hated. The Bible is clear. It says, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory, or we could say the standard of God. There are degrees of evil. There are degrees of breaking the law. But we are all lawbreakers, and that is why we all need Jesus Christ. You need to be forgiven. Some need to be forgiven of much, some of little, but they still need to be forgiven. And that is the whole point of what people call Christianity. It's not just a religion to make you a bit better, to improve your manners. It's God's offer to forgive you of everything you've ever done wrong, if you will come to him, repenting and believing. The offer is there. And we can learn from Jehoram, because he was much better than the king he replaced, but he still fell short of the glory of God. Indeed, this pillar of Baal, I think we come across it again in chapter 10. So he took it down, but he put it into storage. He kept it for a special occasion. He thought, well, we might want to get it out on a future date. You see, that is what man-made moral reformation does. How many of you, on the 1st of January, woke up saying, I'm going to do better at this and better at that. I'm going to do less of that and more of the other. Did you keep? You see, all we can do is put the pillar of Baal into storage, and then we go and get it out again. The gospel of Jesus Christ is not about improving you or modifying you. It's about being born again. When you were born, there was a radical change to the way you existed. You were in a womb, now you're not. And when you become a Christian, the old has gone, the new has come. You get a new nature. You live for God now and not for self. And I appreciate the living illustration which we've just provided there. So we have a king who's quite good, but still not good enough. Later on, he actually shows respect to Elisha. Elisha the prophet was not seeking respect. He wanted a change of heart. And I urge you this morning, come to God, not for him to fiddle around the edges, but to totally change you and breathe new life into you. Become a new creation. In verse 6, so point number 1, in those first few verses, self-improvement doesn't work. Self-improvement is not enough. You come to God as a sinner and come and be forgiven, and then let him totally change you. The second point I'd make comes from the sixth verse. Verses 4 and 5 talk about Mesher, the sheep breeder, who would rather keep hold of his own lambs, thank you very much, and who can blame him. King Jehoram went out of Samaria at that time and mustered all Israel. He summons the army. And then he sends a message to Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, saying, will you go up with me to fight against Moab? And Jehoshaphat says, I will go up. I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. This does sound familiar. If you're familiar with the story of ancient Israel in 1 Kings, you'll know that Jehoshaphat similarly fought with Ahab. Why is Jehoshaphat allying himself with an evil king? In fact, there is some family relations between them. They formed an alliance through marriage. And it might be that Jehoshaphat says, well, he might not totally worship the true God, but at least he's hidden away that pillar. That is something, isn't it? Was it enough? Was it enough? I am as you are. Really? My people as your people. My horses as your horses. If I own a war horse, it is as good as yours. My soldiers, they are there for you to command. Which way shall we go up? Jehoshaphat is ready to go. We ought to be careful with whom we are allied. There are many churches today in this country which have gone astray. Some of you know this all too well. But there will be vicars in pulpits this morning denying that Jesus rose from the dead. What's the point? There'll be some who say there's no such place as hell. I don't want there to be a hell. Goodness me, I deserve it. Christ came to earth that we don't have to go there. That doesn't mean it's not real. And we know the hot topic of the day. There are those who don't believe in male or female. We know people in the world have been saying that for 10 or 20 years. The churches are now saying it. Years ago, women wanted the vote. In this day, if you say there is such a thing as a woman, you're thought strange and old-fashioned. There are those who deny the biblical marriage. Now I ask you, are they fellow believers? Are they fellow travellers? Are our horses as theirs? Shall we go up with them? The answer is no. Those who deny the fundamental truths of the gospel are not people with whom we can fellowship. We can love them. We can be friends with them. But they must not enter this pulpit. And I would struggle to worship with them. What we have here is a godly king of Judah called Jehoshaphat, allying himself with a king of Israel who's still fundamentally pagan, and the king of Edom, who doesn't say anything, he just goes along with it. There's an interesting detail in verse 3 of Jehoram. Nevertheless, he persisted in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Well, actually, he's the fifth king introduced to the text. He was the first king of Israel who re-established golden calf worship and turned the people against the one true God and the temple at Jerusalem. So we may have put away Baal worship, but it would still turn the people away from the one true God. He's not as bad as his father, but he's still like Jeroboam. It might be that your father or your mother really was a rotter. Oh, you saw what they got up to. They might have been well respected in the workplace or on the golf course or the Women's Institute, but you know what they were really like. And you resolved to be different. You wouldn't make that same mistake. You will not treat your children as they treated you. and you made that resolution. But I must say, you're still like Adam. Jehoram was not like Ahab, but he was still like Jeroboam. You might not replicate what you witnessed when you were young, but the fallen blood of Adam the first continues to course through your veins and affects every decision you make, every word you speak, and every thought you think. What you need is not reformation, but Christ. Jehoshaphat has joined himself with an alliance with an ungodly king. For a second time. You know how the people of God do not learn. How I don't learn. So be careful with whom you ally. And the third point I'd make. Is there thirsting in the wilderness? There is a large army. In fact, there is a Judean army, there is an Israelite army, there is an Edomite army, and they're going through the wilderness following a very clever military strategy, no doubt about it. The only problem is they're quite close to the Dead Sea, and it is rather hot there and rather dry, and the Dead Sea does not make good bottled drinking water. And somebody forgot to bring extra. Look at the king of Israel's response in verse 10. Alas, the Lord has called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. Did you notice that? In other words, it's God's fault. Jehoram really was a forward-thinking man. How many people today, both in and without the Church of God, when some adversity comes, say, why has God allowed it to happen? What you mean by that question is, God should have stopped it, but he failed to. God's been caught sleeping. He's taken his eye off the ball. He's losing the plot. As far as I can tell, the Lord never commanded this foray into Moab. As far as I can tell, no one asked him whether it should proceed. Now, later on in the chapter, he graciously actually comes to their help. But we're not there yet. They go off in this ungodly alliance, but they blame God when things go wrong. And Jehoram, and there's no evidence that actually he does turn to the living God. He may have chopped down a pillar or put it into the garage. He may not be as bad as Ahab, but he's still like Jeroboam. He's not wholeheartedly following the Lord his God, but he blames the Lord his God when things go wrong. Let's imagine that instead of getting here safely today, your engine conked out on one of the narrow lanes of Midup. In reality, I think somebody would have stopped to help. But not only are you inconvenienced because you can't get here, but you know that somehow that car has to be collected, and you're going to go to a mechanic and you're going to say, how much will it cost to put it right? And there will be a sharp intake of breath, and he says, oh, it's going to cost you. And you start calculating how much you've got available to pay for it. And as you're sitting there in the car, you might be thinking, why has God brought me here for this to happen? Now, it hasn't happened. It might be, by the way. There's an empty pew there. There is somebody broken down on there. And what I'm speculating is actually reality. But in fact, you are all brought here safely. How many of you thanked God for that journey? In other words, when things go wrong, let's blame God. When things go right, oh, it's nothing to do with him. It was my good driving. It was that nice car I bought. The godless soul will always blame God, but never credit him. Furthermore, the more deeper you go into your Christian faith, the more you realize God even uses pain and trial and hardship for your good. Now, I'm not convinced that Jehoram actually is a child of God. Certainly not at this stage. He's set off on a fairly selfish invasion in order to get his wool and his lambs. He never consulted God, but he blames God when things go wrong. I've no doubt that in this coming week or month, things are going to go wrong in your life. Things will go wrong in my life. Lesson number one. Don't blame God as though you knew what he should have done. He needed your advice, but he never came to ask. Let's not patronize the omnipotent, omniscient creator of the universe. He knows what he's doing. But number two, remember this. He uses hardship for our good. The fourth and final point I'd make is the question with which this morning's text concludes in that 11th verse. But Jehoshaphat said, "Is there no prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of the Lord by him?" I like Jehoshaphat, but he's not perfect. In fact, none of the biblical characters are, apart from Christ. If only Jehoshaphat had asked that question in verse 7. The Lord might have said, "Don't go." Or he might have said, "Go, but take extra water." Now the trouble has come and they're all dying of thirst in the desert. Jehoshaphat thinks, "Hey, we should have asked the Lord." Ask the Lord before, not after. He's gracious. But ask him before, not after. The other point I'd make is, be a Christian of the book. Be a Bible believer. God in his mercy has given us a written record of his dealings, past, future, and present. His thoughts have been recorded on paper that we may ponder them and reflect thereon. Whatever you're going through, ask verse 11, albeit in a New Testament way. Not is there no prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of the Lord by him. I don't believe there are prophets around today, though there are plenty who would tell you otherwise. But rather, will the Lord speak to me today through his written word? I believe that God will always speak to us through his book. The day is coming when this world will be burned up and we will stand before him in heaven. I don't believe we'll be carrying Bibles around with us. I don't believe we'll be attending Bible studies. A, we will know it all off by heart. And B, we will at that point be perfect. But that day is not today. That is not now. Read the Bible. Read it with the expectation that the author will speak to you through it. So four lessons, I think. Number one. to be better than somebody else is not good enough. Come to Jesus Christ and let him forgive you. Number two, both as a believer and as a church, be careful to whom you're yoked. Number three, when you get yourself in a poor state, don't blame God. But at the same time, if you are in that position, call out to him effectively as Jehoshaphat does here. God could have heard Jehoshaphat and said, well, if he'd have asked me at the beginning, I'd have answered. But God is gracious. He is kind. And it might be you have turned your back on him. It might be you have ignored him. It might be you've only given him your third or your fourth best. But his grace and mercy is greater than your sin. Which means your sin might be bad, but his mercy and his grace is greater. And he can forgive and restore and heal and remake.